Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. This hour, Oakland writer Tommy Orange discusses his latest novel, Wandering Stars. We'll also hear pointers about how to slow down and appreciate the world around us from the authors of the book, Today I Noticed. But first, California and the rest of the Western United States has been in the midst of an intense and prolonged heat wave. Records were broken from Washington to Arizona, with temperatures reaching all-time highs in Fresno, Palm Springs, and Redding, among other places. This kind of heat isn't just uncomfortable. It's dangerous to health and harmful to the economy. A new report from the California Department of Insurance reveals that extreme heat has caused more deaths in the state than wildfires and has resulted in $7.7 billion of economic losses over the course of a decade. To tell us more about this landmark report is Kathy Boffman-McLeod. She's a member of the California Climate Insurance Working Group and CEO of Climate Resilience for All, a non-governmental organization dedicated to addressing extreme heat for vulnerable communities. Welcome to State of the Bay, Kathy.
Thank you very much for having me.
Kathy, tell me, why was this report about extreme heat something that the insurance commissioner, Ricardo Lara, authorized?
The costs of extreme heat, as we are experiencing heat at higher, more intense temperatures, it's coming on so quickly. We don't have the kind of data that we need for leaders to make decisions about how much it costs to get ready for a heat wave or to prepare to respond to a heat wave. And so the field of understanding extreme heat is quite immature, and that means that we don't have the kinds of economic analysis we need. And this report begins to fill this huge gap in a real understanding of the economic effects of extreme heat by looking at specific heat events in California. So it's filling a really important gap at a key moment as the world is just roasting.
You know, as we talked about in the introduction here, this recent heat wave broke many records across the state and the West, and, you know, in parts of the Southeast and other parts of the nation and world, it's just getting hotter. What are the significances of these new high temperatures health-wise? It can't be good for your health to be in that constant strain of heat.
Well, that's what's really interesting about heat. You know, it's silent and invisible, and yet it's killing more people than any other climate hazard. And so, you know, that's another reason why this report is so important, is that we have to come up with solutions that protect people's health and their jobs and our economies and infrastructure. And we need the understanding of the way heat is affecting us. And so, you know, to look at seven heat waves that took place in California and have what is a very conservative number of $7.7 billion in impact. I mean, that's pretty eye-popping. And it helps us see, you know, you think about the health of the human body, and, you know, health doesn't land on people the same, in the same way for everybody. And so, you know, vulnerable communities, low-income communities, minority communities are disproportionately affected. And so these types of analyses that help us understand what does heat do to the human body and how much does it cost are essential for implementing the solutions and financing the solutions that we need. And then lastly, you asked about the insurance industry, you know, why the insurance industry. Heat and insurance is a new field. So while we have so much data and understanding about the risks of fire and hurricanes and floods, heat is relatively new. And so building the understanding for the insurance industry is important for helping people, you know, find the protection they need to protect their health and also their jobs and their way of life.
Well, it's interesting that insurance piece, I just want to jump to that quickly, is that, you know, I feel like insurance companies are looking for ways to get out of insuring Californians, whether it's your house or your car or, you know, insurance for earthquakes or wildfires. It's getting just not just more expensive to get insurance, but in some cases impossible. I mean, is there a concern that by compiling this data, it will be used by the insurance industry as an excuse to just not provide coverage for Californians?
Well, I think, you know, from a an NGO perspective, a nonprofit perspective, which is, you know, what I do is run an NGO. We're looking for ways to protect people and their livelihoods from extreme heat. And insurance is one of the ways, you know, it's an approach. It's not just a market product. And yes, the risks of all of these climate hazards are growing. And the key thing is that we have to reduce the risks, not just transfer them. You know, that's what insurance is. We transfer the risk to someone else, to the private market or to a pool of some kind. And so, you know, if you think about, the way that we are rewarded when we quit smoking or when we exercise or when we drive safely, you know, some of those things that have to reduce our risks, we're going to have to do for extreme heat. Now, if that can be done on the scale necessary to make insurance sustainable, I mean, there's so many factors in the pricing of insurance that it's, you know, that's a separate show altogether. Mm-hmm. But when you think about extreme heat, it's a new field of understanding. And the question is, what is the role that insurance plays in helping to protect people and their jobs from extreme heat? And that's the spirit and the thrust of this analysis.
Well, how would insurance help an individual in the face of extreme heat? I'm a little bit confused as what would insurance do for me?
Well, we, you know, Climate Resilience, for all the organization I run, we partnered in India with a women's labor union called the Self-Employed Women's Association, and we partnered with Swiss Re, a big reinsurance company, and an Indian insurance company, and created an insurance policy that each woman in the union was able to access. And it, when the temperature is too hot to work for these workers who are poor and work outside, the insurance kicks in when it's too hot to work. And so they don't lose their income, and they don't lose the ability to feed their family, which is how little resources they have. And so this insurance policy is combined with things that also reduce their risks, like an early warning system. And so the insurance helps them recover their income in the from extreme heat. And they are highly affected. Their health is highly affected. And women are disproportionately impacted by extreme heat. And so it's extra needed because women are, you know, the backbone of communities and taking care of the family and all that sort of stuff. So that's one example that this insurance supports your income when you can't work. So think of it like, you know, you might have at work a heat day instead of a sick day. Think about people who work outside, delivery drivers, the workers in the warehouses, you know, filling all the orders that we make for deliveries, or construction workers, you know, all sorts of people working outside. Would they need extra health coverage for working outside? And would that help them? Would that supplement their income when they can't work? Mm-hmm. And there are lots of people who, when they don't work, they don't get paid. Mm-hmm. And so that's one example. There are others.
Yeah, I mean, sort of like long-term disability insurance pays you when you can't work. So this would be kind of an insurance policy that would pay you when it's too hot outside for you to work.
Exactly. And there's a policy you can buy on your phone in Japan. And it's people who are going to be doing something outside. They've made plans. They've bought tickets. And if it's too hot, they can recoup their money. Or there's also a policy in Nepal. You can buy it if you end up going to the hospital for treatment from heat. And it's so hot in lots of places in the world. You know, in India, they've opened special heat wards and special hospitals for heat victims. And so you see the business community and society adapting to the needs of people who are physically suffering. Their health is suffering from extreme heat.
Mm-hmm. Well, are these kinds of policies affordable? I mean, you mentioned that extreme heat like this disproportionately affects lower income communities. I mean, is it feasible for somebody to buy a policy like this?
Yes, and there is a type of policy called a parametric, and I I hope your listeners love insurance as much as I do.
Well, it's kind of instructive because we hear a lot about extreme heat, but really, as you're saying, I mean, we can talk all day long about 120 degrees and how that might affect your body. Not good. Planes can't fly. I mean, the asphalt melts. Right. But really, this is such a, on the one hand, arcane, but very basic concept.
It is a basic concept, and your organs can't function. Your skin can only sweat so much. I mean, you know, the body can only hold, take so much. And so do we understand at what temperature that is? And does everybody know the signs of extreme heat? When you see a heat stroke coming on to a colleague or somebody in your family, do you recognize the signs? Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are also things that everybody needs to know, that the nighttime temperatures are as important as the daytime temperatures. And if you don't sleep well at night and rest because you're too hot, you wake up and you make mistakes. And some fantastic work that was done by a researcher who was at UCLA, Jisung Park, who looked at the workers' comp data. So how many accidents and injuries and deaths were recorded around workplace injury due to high temperature, and, you know, put the two together and found, you know, immense connection between hot temperatures and more accidents. And so, you know, you a worker, you lose money, the company loses money, and, you know, an analysis done in 2021 showed the U.S. economy losing $100 billion a year due to worker productivity losses. And so, you know, just us as a, it's not just a weather phenomenon we need to understand. This is a cultural phenomenon. Mm-hmm. We'll be changing the way that we live and thinking about how we plan our day and doing our personal heat risk assessments. And, you know, our brains don't fully comprehend how quickly the heat has come on. Mm. And, you know, healthy people go out for a hike and don't come back.
Right.
And so.
Right. Well, I think that one interesting aspect to this kind of work is the moral argument to stop climate change. It's out there, but maybe it's not working. Maybe, though, if we put a price tag to how climate change is affecting us, you know, the cost of it, you said 7.7, the report said $7.7 billion over the last decade.
Just for seven heat waves.
Just
that's only for seven.
Yeah, and so that might be another argument for people who are less persuaded by the moral argument to say, like, hey, maybe we should do something. I mean, this report notes that California is creating an extreme heat ranking system called the Cal Heat Score. It's set to roll out next year. What is that going to be like, and how will it help mitigate the impacts of extreme heat?
So if we were talking about reducing your risks of extreme heat, the best way is for everyone to know about it. You know, the awareness is one of the biggest problems. It's called the silent killer. You know, you can't see it, can't hear it, doesn't have a name, doesn't have an agency. It's like the orphan climate hazard, and yet it's killing so many people. And so this health-based warning system or ranking system was another one of the recommendations that came out of the insurance working group with Commissioner Lara. And the idea is that you can connect a specific community in a weather basin and your expected, your death rate. So you use all cause mortality. Like, how many people die per day in Alameda County? So how many people die per day? And then you have the temperature, you have the nighttime temperature, you have the cloud cover, and you have the humidity. Those are important factors in determining sickness and death from heat. And so you can project how many more people, what percentage increase in all-cause mortality do you expect from this specific heat wave in this specific community? And, you know, you can say we expect a 30% increase. So that means that X more people will die over the next 3 days with this heat coming. And so if you know this and you can say to the community, you know, I don't know if you're saying 20% of you are going to die. I don't think that's a great way to go. I think it's more like these are extremely deadly conditions. These are the things you should do. And the key thing with early warning is finding the trusted channel of information that each community, you know, receives in, you know, not everybody's using Twitter, not everybody's using or X, you know, people are using a radio or or right. billboards or the neighbor tells you or whatever. But whatever those systems are, we're going to need them. And that health-based warning system is better calibrated to a specific community. It's a great thing. I mean, you know, to have California population, 40 million people under that's a fantastic thing. And the science and the learning we'll have from that to help other jurisdictions
pick up
the health-based warning system.
Well, Kathy, I want to thank you for kind of shedding light on a somewhat arcane but very, very important topic. Really appreciate it. That was Kathy Boffman-McLeod. She's a member of the California Climate Insurance Working Group and CEO of Climate Resilience for All. Thanks again, Kathy, for joining us.
Thank you.
Up next, acclaimed author Tommy Orange on his book, Wandering Stars. It's a prequel and a sequel to There, There. If you read it, you know how good it was. Stay with us to hear more from Tommy Orange.
Hi, I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. On Wednesday, July 24th, come be part of a live recording of Philosophy Talk at KALW's San Francisco Event Space.
We'll be thinking about how to do things with your mind with Stanford philosopher Antonia Peacock.
This event is free and open to the public. More information at philosophytalk.org.
That's Wednesday, July 24th, 7 p.m. at 220 Montgomery Street in downtown San Francisco.
Do things with your mind with us.
This week on The Arts, you'll hear about the San Francisco Playhouse current production of Evita. Plus, this year's San Francisco Mime Troupe production of American Dreams, coming to a park near you. Philippa Kelly tells us about the San Francisco Shakespeare Company's production of The Tempest, and Peter Robinson on the latest of Billy Collins' poems. I'm David LaTulipe. Join me on The Arts Wednesday afternoon at 4.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. My guest tonight is Oakland native and acclaimed author Tommy Orange. Many of you may be familiar with Orange's debut novel, There, There. It was a Pulitzer Prize finalist and a national bestseller that captured the contemporary urban native experience. Now, Tommy Orange is back with a new book, Wandering Stars. It's both a prequel and a sequel to There, There. And Wandering Stars delves into the transgenerational impact of trauma that reverberates through the history of Native American families. It also tackles addiction, trauma. It has it all, and it does so with empathy. Tommy, welcome back to State of the Bay, and congratulations on the book.
Hi, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
And State of the Bay listeners, we're going to open up our phone lines early tonight so we can hear from you. Have you read There, There, or Wandering Stars, or both? What was your reaction to Orange's work? You can give us a call, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or send us a message on Twitter at State of Bay, or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. So, as I mentioned, I mean, Wandering Stars at its core is about legacies. It's a prequel and a sequel, and centers around a young Native American Oaklander who was in your first novel. What is the weight of legacy for the characters in this book?
Yeah, so I initially was writing a pretty straightforward sequel that had no historical context and was not talking about the weight of history. And I sort of stumbled into this history of Native people being imprisoned in Florida from between 1875 and 1878. And that being the basis for the boarding school system in the U.S., Richard Henry Pratt created the boarding schools, the first one being Carlisle Indian Industrial School, with the sort of motto, kill the Indian, save the man. He got the inspiration for that school from a period between 1875 and 1878 in Florida at a prison castle called Fort Marion. And half of the prisoners there were Southern Cheyenne people. And so I'm Southern Cheyenne, and I found this piece of history while I was touring for the translation of the Swedish publication of There, There in Sweden, and I was offered a visit to a museum, and I discovered just like next to some stuff that they were showing me of of stuff that they had, sort of candidly telling me, we have your guys' stuff. Do you want to see it? In a sort of awkward way. And I saw this newspaper clipping from that time period, and I fell down this rabbit hole, and it just felt, I felt drawn to it. Mm. And I realized, or once I started doing research, I found that one of the prisoners' names was Star, and I already had the working title as Wandering Stars. But also one of the prisoners' names was Bearshield, and that's one of the central families from there. So I was already working on a straightforward sequel, and I realized I was at this moment, because there was this prisoner at this prison castle, that I was going to try to connect this piece of history to the next book. And so that was, you know, it took 6 years to write there, and it took 6 years to write Wandering Stars. And there's a lot of factors involved, but trying to tie in this historical piece, which I did not initially intend to do, was, it was a lot.
I mean, I can imagine being in that moment, like doing that research, and I mean, to see the name in a historical document of a character that you wrote about in your first book. I mean, was that just like a goosebump sort of moment?
I mean, to be completely honest, I started crying.
Oh.
It was the more than goosebump moment, mm-hmm. because, you know, I wrote from this Bearshield name out of nowhere. It wasn't something that I knew about from history. It was sort of random. Mm. So getting involved with writing a novel has a lot of these sort of mysterious aspects to it. And I don't want to sound like woo-woo about it, but there are weird things that happen.
I think the woo-woo is the best part. I love that.
I just don't want to sound that way.
Understood. Well, so, I mean, when the novel starts, it begins with this depiction of an 1864 massacre of the Cheyenne and Arapaho people at Sand Creek in Colorado. It's really gripping. And, you know, you probably get a lot of questions about what's your process? How do you figure out what's going where? I mean, to start the book that way, did that just come to you out of this research that you had done and this moment?
No. So beginning with Sand Creek has everything to do with having a father who heard from his grandmas and great grandmas a very specific story about what happened. So we're pretty close to the story and the survivors of the massacre.
Mm.
And so that was one of the stories that I grew up hearing. And in a way, it was once I realized that I was going to write from a historical place, it was always going to include Sand Creek, because that was a sort of central part of the story that I heard growing up.
Hmm. Well, it reminds me of this line, or this passage from the book that Orville contemplates, and Orville was a character in the first novel and is in this one. And he says, or you write, past family members and the ancestors were constantly sending their blessings and curses down through time from that beyond before that gave his present its particular bent, its dimness, its light, its scream, and its song, but also its sometimes dead silence. I mean, for you too, it's like hearing that oral history of what had happened before. I mean, I guess it did provide a particular bent to your present.
For sure. And all of that complexity of receiving and not receiving this like message of what it means to be a Native person living in the 21st century is everything like that I write about, because it's really complex. And like, you know, my dad was an engineer at the Lawrence Berkeley Labs for 20 years. Hmm. And he was also, you know, a practitioner of the Native American Church. And my mom is white. And so I grew up in Oakland, which is super diverse, and on a street that every other kid that I knew came from a biracial family. So all of that stuff, I didn't know that I was doing it while I was writing it, but all of that ended up going into the writing of it. That's all part of the process, I guess.
So good. So good. I mean, when I just to talk back to about Richard Henry Pratt, who is the sort of prison master of this prison in Florida. I mean, you portrayed him in a relatively sympathetic light, despite the atrocities committed against the people in his prisons and boarding schools. I mean, did you feel some sympathy for that character?
Yeah, I did a lot of research into him, and I think I knew about him more peripherally and about the boarding schools peripherally. And he, if you don't know about him without doing a lot of research into him, he's just like a villain role. He's just like this evil dude. And I realized doing the research that there's a lot of other white men in power from the time period who were way worse and thought way worse things about Native people. And so it became interesting to me to write about him trying to represent where he was coming from. I'm not trying to like defend him. He was of his time, and he had a lot of dumb ideas about Native people, not fully thinking of us as human in the same way, but getting closer than anybody else. You know, he said at one point, I would abolish all of the boarding schools if it was allowed that Native students could be integrated into the public school system, which had just like pretty newly been created. And that was not a consideration. This is like way pre civil rights era integration from segregation. He literally wanted Native students to be considered to go into public schools, and nobody else ever would ever, come close to thinking that could be a possibility. So the more I read about him, the more I was like, I want to write this person, and where they're at, and not keep him as demonized, because there were worse people, including Theodore Roosevelt, at the time. The way they thought about Native people was worse than his view. And so just trying to contextualize this piece of American history that a lot of us don't learn in schools and don't know about unless you end up knowing about it.
I mean, that's a kind of a theme of your work, which is to take what we've had in the past, just caricature views of the Native American experience, and adding context to making them people. Like, this person had some pretty significant flaws, but of his time, he was a person, and you tried to humanize him. So, which I think is what makes that fascinating. I'm going to reintroduce the show. This is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW Bay Area. I'm Grace Wan. We're talking to Bay Area author Tommy Orange about his book, Wandering Stars, and we'd love to hear from you. Have you read Wandering Stars, and what was your reaction to the book? And, have you read There, There, and did you want to read more? Because I remember picking up There, There, saying, what happens next? And then getting to read Wandering Stars and finding out. So you can talk to Tommy directly by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or email us at stateofthebay@klw.org. Or find us on X. We're at State of Bay. Tommy, another theme of this book is the trauma that comes from this experience. And part of the trauma is addiction. And your story follows the lineage of one family, and it traces the lineage of kind of the various types of addictions that these individuals have. I mean, one character, it's alcohol, then it's laudanum for another character, alcohol, opioids. I mean, you name it, fentanyl, hydrocodone. And actually, something called Blanks, which I looked up and I discovered that's a lifestyle brand and a whitening toothpaste, and I guess a street drug. And that's certainly a human history there of coping with trauma by numbing yourself. Was that an important piece of the story to tell?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I think I was never not going to write about addiction because it's been a big piece of my family history and of my life. But also, you know, it gets stigmatized and talked about in ways that are like it's a moral failing, which, you know, skirts the idea that people are going to these sources to heal or to try to heal or to try to cope instead of like just being like bad people. Like that's still in the language and in the thinking about addicts. It's still, we still don't really understand, I think, in the way we talk about addiction, that a large part of it, it's not 100%, but a large part of what's going on is people trying to figure out how to cope with trauma. And so I wanted to write about it in a way that deals with that aspect in the historical piece. And, you know, Native people have been sort of thrown into this category of like, we just have a weakness for alcohol. Specifically, that's the drunk Indian is like a trope, right? And it's just so much more complex than that. And it's not just Native people. There's a lot of populations of people that are survivors of colonization and the different ways that the U.S. government has imposed itself on people's lives and has taken from people. And I just wanted to try to, you know, get a microscope on the internal lives of people and what that looks like in relation to addiction. So that's, you know, that was, I think, because it's affected my life, I wanted to try to write about it in a novel in a way that tries to comprehend how it, what it can look like and in a way that the reader might understand it from this level of, you know, it can be generational, it can be, I don't want to say in the genes, but to see like in real time over hundreds of years, like how it can be passed down.
Well, we have a question from a listener who asks, I have read, Tommy, that you were not a big reader growing up. What advice can you offer to the parent of a kid who doesn't like to read?
Very hard question for this this time period. I have a 13-year-old son who he's not necessarily a reader, and I, you know, I don't try to force it on him because I love it. He loves books when he loves books, basically when they're good, and when they get him, he loves it. I think we're in a really exciting time right now to reach kids that before were like sort of forced into a certain kind of canon of experience that this is what books you have to read through an education. I think especially if you live in the Bay Area, there's a diverse range of books that are recommended. There's a lot of audiobooks for kids that sometimes maybe have a harder time with physical books. I can't recommend anything specifically other than that there are more resources now than there have been in the past, and audiobooks are a really good way for young people to connect, even encouraging them to listen to books while they do other things. Can be a good way to encourage, like, you know, go for a walk. Even, and this may sound like bad advice, let them listen to a book and play video games. Not every kid can do it, but like,
I love it.
There's a way that the brain can sort of compartmentalize this experience, and they can for me, my brain, if I'm doing something, I can listen to a book better if I'm doing something than if I'm just like sitting there listening to a book. So there's a lot of options, basically. I don't have any like inspirational words or specific books to point you toward. I just think it's a really good time for kids that are afflicted by things right now that are really hard to pull them away from all the distractions. It's a really good time. There's a lot of remedies right now for the problems.
I mean, interestingly, I have asked around. There is on a lot of reading lists for students. I think that might be the ultimate compliment of a book for especially young readers, right? And I'm just curious, what have your young readers told you about reading that book and what it's meant to them?
So I made the mistake. I was on an interview at the beginning of the tour for Wandering Stars. I was on a live radio interview, and I told this story. I'm not going to make the mistake again, but because I say a cuss word because it's part of the story. I'll say it differently so it doesn't happen again. So I went to a school in Oakland, and they brought in like a little TV thing, and they had kids interview me. And after the interview, I was going out to my car, and this group of young boys were nearby, and you know, sort of nervous. I'm always nervous around young people, more so than anybody else. And
because they're the truth tellers, young kids are the truth tellers.
yeah. This kid called out to me in the parking lot, and he was like, "Hey," and I turned around. He was like, and I'm gonna sanitize the language here. He was like, "I F with your book." And this is like a kid from Oakland. This is like deep East Oakland telling me like he's into the book. So there's been a lot of those experiences that have been amazing. And sort of the later part of the experience of having they're out. Because like the beginning of the reception of the book was like critics and like old white people and like people into literature in a way that it's like you would go to a bookstore and see me read if you knew, and that's like one of your hobbies or whatever. But I feel like post-pandemic, there's been a huge surge of young people interested, and I've had amazing experiences with young people connecting to it and even like making them feel like they want to be readers because of it. And that's like the highest compliment to me.
It really is. And I mean, if people haven't picked up the book, and if you're a young listener or your parents are listening to this, I'll say there's a passage where a character makes a list on how to become a super Indian or how to be a super Indian that is so funny. And even for that one page alone, it's worth picking up the book, I think. So tell me, you're Oakland born and raised, and in the acknowledgments of this book, you thank the city of Oakland and say for you thank its people for all the ways you have made me who I am, made this book and the first book what they became. You know, the city has been going through a tough time, and I wondered, how do you feel about Oakland right now?
I mean, I'll always love Oakland because it's my home. I think the way it's being portrayed is one thing, and the way the state of what it is another thing. Like, it's being portrayed, especially by like right wing people, like this wasteland, or like, you know, an example of liberal cities going wrong or whatever, crime, you know, this is all like politically driven to get a law and order president into power. Like, it's all that kind of BS. It has stayed the same in a lot of essential ways that make me continue to love it. You know, I just moved back here 2 years ago. I was away for 7 years. And the ways that it has stayed the same, I'll always love it for that. And I don't think that's going to go away. You know, losing the Warriors and losing the A's and the Raiders is all kind of like brutal stuff. And, you know, if you follow the whatever app, about the neighbor apps.
I know what you're talking about. Yep.
There's crime going on everywhere all the time. And it's, you know, it really kind of dehumanizes and takes away from the soul of what Oakland is and its value, because there's a lot of good happening here and has always been. So Oakland in some ways, because it's so fantastic, can also become a symbol for another thing. Mm-hmm. And because it has such a rich history, it can be used to mean something else. So I don't know. It's a complex city and there's a lot going on here. And I'm not one to say like we're in bad shape and whatever the rhetoric is right now around Oakland. Mm-hmm. There, the ways that the reasons I've always loved Oakland are still in place now. Mm. And maybe I'll second guess that if something drastic happens, but it doesn't feel, you know, different enough for me right now to make me feel like.
Well, it plays, it's actually its own character in this book, which is really nice. You know, with the 2 minutes that we have left, I wanted to end with just talking about your own father. You've said he is a role model, your role model, in his ease and comfort with his Cheyenne identity. He was raised, as you said earlier, by his grandparents in Oklahoma. He speaks the language fluently. Your mother is not Native American, and I think at one point you write she had orange hair, drove an orange van, much to your sister's dismay. And I'm just curious, do you feel like because of your father's example, you have been able to model this for the next generation of your own family?
I don't think I've ever said my father is my role model. In it.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that. All right.
That's okay. That's totally fine. Uh-huh. The other things you've said about him are true. Mm-hmm. I think there are ways that he did not pass on stuff to me that were not a good example for how to carry on the next generation. Mm. I think there was, he's from a generation of assimilation being the safer bet. Mm-hmm. I think he was trying to protect me from certain wounds and pain from his childhood that made it seem like not passing on, for example, the language since he's fluent, or telling a lot about what his childhood was. He was very reticent as a father. I think there was an element of protection that I commend him for trying, that also took away from and added to a certain amount of insecurity about authenticity because he didn't pass certain things on. So it's a really complex thing.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the white mom thing and being a Native person who has freckles and has had comments when I'm out touring on the road from audience members, like, you look white to me. Oof. When did you decide you were a Native person?
Ooh.
Like, consistently, I've had, you know, at least 10 or so times where people ask the question and, you know, it's, there's certain like bona fide things that you have as a Native person that have to do with connection to community, connection to language, knowledge of history. Mm-hmm. And some of those things, because I was raised in Oakland and he didn't necessarily raise us in a traditional way, because there are ways he was not connected to it, that have become very complicated being a public Native author figure. Mm. And not necessarily emboldened in the way that you're saying, like,
yeah,
that I'm like passing on this generational torch of like, this is what's important. Like, I write about it in my work, mm-hmm. and I hope that does what it can do.
Well, I mean, first of all, thank you for that clarification and apologies for that. But it's been such a pleasure to talk to you, Tommy, about your book, and we've just scratched the surface of it. Again, we've been talking to Tommy Orange, author of Wandering Stars and the Pulitzer Prize nominated There, There. Thanks again for being on State of the Bay, Tommy.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
And coming up after the break, we'll hear from Fred Pitts, his interview with co-authors Deborah Hubner and Willow Older. Their new book is Today I Noticed. Stay tuned.
On the Emergence Magazine Listening Hour, we explore the threads connecting ecology, culture, and spirituality. In our next episode, I'm joined by writer Robert McFarlane to discuss the magic and intimacy that is lost in our relationship with the earth and how language and landscape have entwined throughout his life.
What might happen if you could summon back into the mouth what also should be summoned back into the landscape?
Join us Mondays at 7 p.m. on KALW.
Tonight we will tap into the power of paying attention with this clever little book called Today I Noticed. Not enough time to meditate? Slowing down and noticing the little moments of ordinary life just might be that solution. Here to talk about their whimsical, clever, and incredibly relatable book are the authors, Willow Older and Deborah Huber. Welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you.
Deborah, so tell us, how did the two of you decide to collaborate on this book together?
Willow and I have been friends for quite a while. One day we went to MoMA, Museum of Modern Art, and we got there early and were waiting in line, except there wasn't a line. It was just us. And it turns out it was just us because the museum was closed on Wednesdays. So we decided to, instead of just throw the day away, we said, let's go for a little urban walking tour and just cruise around San Francisco. And we made a decision to really pay attention to what was around us and the sights and sounds and smells and notice things. And we just like got this brainstorm, well, let's do this every day. Not the walk part, but just the noticing part. So we agreed that we would spend every day carrying this phrase, Today I Notice, around with us and noticing the world more.
Interesting. So, Willow, tell us about this book that came out of it, Today I Noticed.
I'd love to tell you about it. First, I have to share the subtitle because it's a good one. And it's a little book of mindfulness that will change the way you see the world. So it's a collection of our observations, which we call TINs. And that is a simple sentence that starts with the words, Today I Noticed. And then it is an illustration of some kind that resonates or somehow illustrates the observation. And most of them are done with pen and ink and a little splash of watercolor. And it has been a wonderful creative process for all of us. And we're excited for other people to enjoy that process as well. And Fred, you used the word relatable, right, with mm-hmm. introduction. And that yeah. is what we have found time and again. We have followers from all over the world. And the sort of messages we get from them are these little moments are real points of connection, of sharing, of understanding, empathy. And honestly, in this time of turmoil and chaos in the world, it feels like a really valuable thing to remember that we have so many things in common. And often there are these little moments.
Give us a few examples of some of your personal favorite Today I Noticed observations, and even the ones that you've noticed from other people that you liked.
Sure. I'll just read a couple from my pages in the book. Today I noticed what a difference a good night's sleep makes. And I want to mention this, first of all, because we can all relate to that.
Mm-hmm.
And also because when you look at this tin, you'll see this is not me trying to draw what I look like getting out of bed after I've been up all night, but it's two abstract, very simple watercolor marks on the page. One is sort of dark, muddy, gray colors. That's how I feel navigating the world after no sleep versus the bright yellow, red, oranges of that, you know, the vibrant way you feel when you get up and you've had a great 8 hours or 9 hours of sleep. Mm-hmm. So point is, you don't have to be a skilled artist to put a mark on the page that somehow illustrates or resonates with the observation.
Okay. And Deborah, how about you? Some of your favorites.
This one says, today I notice how disappointing it is when I'm eavesdropping and the people walk away before they finish the story.
I saw that too.
It's a picture of someone, maybe me, maybe not, sitting on a bench and two people are walking away chatting and you can't hear them.
One of the things I liked about the book, there are a couple of, I call them the verbal tints, or today I noticed, and two of my favorites were the difference between and but, because one is kind of a little bit of an accommodation. One of them is that just, I accept you for who you are, and that's the end of the story. And the other one, the personal favorite for me, is it could be worse, because we find ourselves sometimes when we say it, it feels like I'm looking at the situation going, you know, half glass, half full. And sometimes when I receive that from someone else, it doesn't come off the same way.
You're absolutely right. It's so easy to replace but with and. And now that I'm aware of it, I do it all the time, whether I'm speaking with someone or certainly in an email, because it really changes the way the message comes across. It's actually something that we talk about specifically when we run workshops for companies and teams, which we do, because that is an awareness that can really help move a conversation forward or shut it down.
The workshops you run, you mentioned that they're for, are they mostly for businesses, or do you have workshops just for individuals who want to, you know, learn about today I noticed?
We can do both. We've done a lot of workshops for teams, for companies. We've also spoken with people talking about our book in book club environments, author events.
How has this project changed you? And you can both answer this question.
I think for me, it has, because it has helped me slow down and really be more present, it's helped me appreciate, well, what we always say, it's the little moments. It helps me. I think when you pay attention to something, you can't help but feel some sort of appreciation for it because you're looking more closely at it, whether it's something you're feeling or something you're seeing or hearing, et cetera.
It's very true. Something else I found in the book when I was reading your introduction, the big words, mindfulness for all, which I loved. You also talk about the magic that you hope comes from this book. Can you give us some examples of what kind of magic that you hope comes from the book and the kind of magic that you observed or heard from people with conferences, Instagram, et cetera?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think Deborah has just sort of mentioned a couple of the benefits, but let me just say that noticing is a totally natural act. We are all noticing things all the time. And when we start tuning into and sort of noticing what we're noticing, that's where this little mindset shift really becomes a mindfulness practice. And there is a stickiness about noticing in terms of a mindfulness practice that really takes away any burden. You don't need a meditation pillow. You don't need to carve out special time. You don't need a dark room or silence or any of those things. You can carry this phrase with you. And when you do, and this is what our readers and our followers tell us, that they are instantly able to access a sense of gratitude, a sense of presence, a sense of nourishment, and you get to do it anywhere, everywhere.
Why do you think mindfulness is that important today?
Well, I think, as we all know, we're living in pretty difficult times, and there's a lot of division and anger and challenging problems. And I think that mindfulness is a really great way to sort of to temporarily pull you out of that focus so that you can feel grounded and separate from the difficulties and hardships you might be experiencing on a personal level or a world level. I think it's very, very helpful and healthy for your state of mind and your spirit.
And I think if I can just add there, with today, I noticed in particular, because we're really focusing on these little moments, as we've already said, they're points of real connection. And when you feel like you can connect with someone, doesn't matter what the topic is or the moment is, that increases your sense of compassion, of empathy, understanding, and really of curiosity, we need these things more than ever.
I agree. If you're interested in this book, Today I Noticed, you can buy a copy of it everywhere that books are sold. Deborah, Willow, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's really been enlightening.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Fred.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We hope you'll join us next Monday at 6 for a discussion about Bay Area Olympians. And we want to thank all our guests and listeners this evening for being part of the conversation. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on KALW.org. And if you have any questions or comments or even a show idea, you can email us at stateofthebay@KALW.org. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang, Jillian Emblad, and Wendy Holcomb. It was engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor is our board operator. I'm Grace Wan. Good night, and thanks for listening.